This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
KPFT is my link to the truth and the blues, to diverse communities and points of view, and to a family of people who share my fears and hope for the planet. Please vote for me, Susan Young, and please vote in this board election. It's important.
This is 90.1 KPFT, Houston. Please vote in the upcoming station board election. Now here's one of our candidates.
Hello, my name is Brian Swain, and I'm running for the KPFT local station board because I believe that a vibrant alternative media outlet is a key contributor to making Houston a great place to live and work. I have served on the board for the past 10 months, and with your support, I will continue working to make KPFT a station we can all be proud of. My background in business and technology will enable me to have a lasting impact on the station, and my strong international experience gives me a broad perspective on the challenges that the board and the station face every day. I encourage you to contact me either by email at bswain2000@yahoo.com or by phone at 713-436-2714 to share your questions and concerns about the future of the station. I'm Brian Swain, and I sincerely appreciate your support.
This is 90.1 KPFT, Houston.
Point one FM. This is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening. This is Jack Belinsky.
And Jennifer Renee.
Deborah Bell.
And Greg Chapman.
And Glenn Holt.
And Elisar Saliva.
And tonight, the post-election show, which is actually going to be a lot of fun. Tonight, Greg Chapman and Glenn Holt talk with Mel White, best-selling author of Strangers at the Gate, about his book, Religion Gone Bad. Mel and his partner, Gary Nixon, are founders of Soul Force, which is dedicated to nonviolence action to counter the extreme right and to reclaim religion and GLBT people of faith. Jeff Reed from the Houston Equality Rights Alliance, HERA, talks with Jennifer Renee and myself talking about the election results. Also, I will be talking to Frida Mock about the new documentary about Tony Kushner entitled Wrestling with Angels. Then, Deborah Bell talks with Jason Stewart, one of the co-stars of the new film Coffee Date. Todd, a straight man, forms an unexpected friendship with a gay man after being set up as a joke by his brother through an online dating service. Soon everyone assumes that Todd really is gay, including his mother. Coffee Date opens Friday at the Algenica. Lily Roddy joins Jennifer Renee to discuss this year's Transgender Day of Remembrance, which is held next Monday at the Holocaust Museum. Plus, This Way Out. I think we have to pad a little bit because we don't have This Way Out quite ready.
I'm looking at you like, what are you talking about?
It's a little bit of dead air there, wasn't it?
Yeah, the thing we hate the most in radio, that and not getting enough pledges for our pledge drive.
Well, one of the other plugs we can do is for Ray Hill's film that is going to be this weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Rice Media Center. And it's called Ray Hill's Prison Show. And also playing is The Last Day of Charles Catherine. Both are documentaries.
Charles Catherine McGuire.
Well, it doesn't say that here, so.
Well, Outsmart got it wrong.
None of us are always right like you, Deborah.
Oh.
So, anyway.
I was wrong that one other time.
Yes. What was it, 1989?
The film is playing this weekend at Rice Media Center, and that's at entrance number 8, University Boulevard. It shows Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at 8 p.m. It's a real minimal cost. And if you have a copy of today's Chronicle, you can look at the front page of the Metropolitan section, which discusses Ray's film.
And what is his film about?
The Prison Show.
Ah.
The Prison Show, which is played here on KPFT on Friday evenings at
excellent program. Mm-hmm. And then The Last Days of Charles Catherine McGuire is about local socialite, Catherine McGuire, who used to be Charles McGuire and who transitioned and had a documentary made of the process. And I think she's moved on to another city.
Oh, absolutely. And I remember when I was just a small boy at the time, and it gave me an inspiration that, you know, maybe Houston, Texas, it would be okay to be a girl.
She was a lovely person.
Let's say she was a little bit bizarre, but then again, aren't we all?
Well, hey, I had
seen her at a couple of parties. She did go over the top a few times.
Well,
she dressed well, and what was always tickled me was she was in the society column the time.
It's called money.
Yeah, but I mean, she'd be at things at River Oaks and you know, things happening with Lynn Wyatt and Carolyn Favre and all those people.
You donate enough, you can go to those parties.
Yes, but you know, it was just like, oh, well, you know, this is just a very natural and, of course, thing. We will be having some music, although J.D. is not with us tonight. He's working on his next segments of Queer Music Heritage. And we have a lot on the show tonight, so
I heard somebody talking about what's on the show tonight.
Well, Jack was talking about it earlier, weren't you?
By the way, I sent Ray an email earlier today, not asking him about his documentary, but about the fact that he's doing special programming for World AIDS Day, which is December 1st. And I said, make sure you send me the details so that we can announce it. So sometime between now and then, we'll have that information.
And also, Ray was part of the election coverage here on KPFT, along with Leo Gold, who was a very good. Leo Gold's show is on Thursday at midday, the new Capital. It's a really good show. He gave this great sort of editorial on our good old friend Rush Limbaugh about the hatred that he spills out.
And lies.
Exactly.
And once again proving that Al Franken was right when he called him a big fat liar. A big fat idiot.
Saying that, let's listen.
Are we ready?
To the news.
Maybe.
I'm Rick Watts.
And I'm Don Lupo.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending November 11th, 2006. Mexico City lawmakers approved a measure this week to legally recognize same-gender unions. It's the first such measure by a legislative body in the history of Mexico, a conservative, predominantly Roman Catholic country. Mexico City Mayor Alejandro Encinas supported the bill and is expected to sign it into law. At least one conservative non-governmental group, the National Pro-Life Committee, said it might request a court injunction to overturn it. The bill allows gay and lesbian couples to register their unions with civil authorities, granting them property, pension, inheritance, and even co-parenting rights, but stops short of full marriage equality or allowing the adoption of children. The left-leaning Democratic Revolutionary Party has pushed for the law in the Mexican capital for years. The vote was 43-17, with all the opposition coming from the conservative National Action Party of President Vicente Fox and President-elect Felipe Calderón. Their party has consistently voiced support for so-called traditional families. The bill was also severely criticized by the country's Roman Catholic bishops. Mexico City, with a population of 8.7 million, could be part of an increasingly progressive movement in parts of Latin America for lesbi-gay rights. The Mexican capital appears poised to join the Argentine capital of Buenos Aires and the southern Brazilian state of Rio Grande do Sul, which have also enacted civil unions legislation. Lawmakers in Costa Rica and Colombia have debated, but not yet passed, national civil union measures.
A twice-postponed LGBT pride parade in Jerusalem, scheduled for November 10th, could not overcome continuing tensions in the Middle East, and a pride rally in a tightly guarded sports stadium was held instead on the outskirts of the Holy City. The planned pride march had been violently opposed for several days by hundreds of rioting ultra-Orthodox Jews, who threatened further violence if the parade proceeded. Dozens were arrested, and there were injuries to several police officers called in to restore order on an almost daily basis. About 4,000 gays, lesbians, and their supporters gathered at Hebrew University's Givat Ram Stadium for the four-hour rally that featured vendors, entertainment, dancing, and speeches. One banner read, "There are different ways to be a Jew." Two men dressed as sperm handed out condoms to participants. The parade was originally planned to coincide with a quadrennial World Pride Festival in Jerusalem, which itself was postponed because it would have been held during the volatile time of an Israeli troop withdrawal from Gaza. The delayed week-long festival was eventually held in August, but the parade was canceled because of the conflict with the Lebanon-based Hezbollah at the time. The latest attempt to hold a pride parade was canceled by Israeli police the day before it was scheduled because of heightened tensions following an errant Israeli shelling in Gaza that killed several Palestinian civilians. The pride events had also been consistently criticized by Muslim and Christian religious leaders in Israel and elsewhere. The Vatican demanded cancellation of the parade for fear of offending the sensibilities of religious communities. Perhaps ironically, the last World Pride event, including a parade, was held in Rome in 2002, despite strong opposition from the Vatican, but there was no violence there. Security was tight in Jerusalem on November 10th, with at least 3,000 Israeli police deployed to secure the pride rally. Earlier in the day, five Orthodox teens carrying brass knuckles, clubs, knives, and a loaded pistol were arrested. Authorities believe they were planning to violently disrupt the event. Police also prevented about 50 LGBT activists who had gathered at the city's Liberty Bell Park from holding a spontaneous march to the rally. At least 20 of them were arrested after they refused to get on buses to the university.
A wave of dissatisfaction with President George W. Bush's war in Iraq and seemingly endless charges of corruption against several congressional Republicans swept Democrats into power in both the U.S. House and Senate in national midterm elections this week. Nancy Pelosi, a liberal Democrat from San Francisco with an excellent record on LGBT issues, is expected to become the first ever female Speaker of the House. A wide-ranging ban on not only same-gender marriage and civil unions, but also domestic partnerships for unmarried couples, was defeated in Arizona. Although the margin was slim, it was the first time that's happened to any initiative involving legal recognition of gay and lesbian couples in more than two dozen states where such measures have been on the ballot. But in Colorado, an initiative prohibiting same-gender marriage passed, and a separate measure to create domestic partnerships was defeated. Voters in Wisconsin also passed a constitutional amendment banning same-gender marriage and civil unions by a significant margin, disappointing queer activists who had hoped for a victory there. Bans on marriage equality and civil unions passed in five other states: Idaho, South Carolina, Tennessee, South Dakota, and Virginia, all traditionally red conservative states. But the measures in South Dakota and Virginia won by much narrower margins than in recent years elsewhere: 52-48% in South Dakota and 57-43% in Virginia. It's clear that fear-mongering around same-sex marriage by the GOP and the extreme Christian right is fizzling out, said Matt Forman, executive director of the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force. It doesn't have the juice it had just 2 years ago. People are getting sick of it.
As if to confirm Forman's comments, Massachusetts lawmakers meeting in a special joint convention this week delayed a vote on a proposed amendment to the state constitution to limit marriage to heterosexual couples. Proponents had hoped the measure would go on the 2008 state ballot through a complicated process of consecutive legislative approvals, but the delay appears to have killed its chances of ever going to the voters. In a procedural maneuver, lawmakers voted 109-87 to recess until January 2nd, the last official day of the session. Because they didn't formally adjourn, it would seem to prevent termed-out Republican Governor Mitt Romney, an outspoken opponent of marriage equality, from ordering the legislature back into session over the next 2 months. Speaking on behalf of the over 8,000 queer couples who've legally married in Massachusetts since the Supreme Judicial Court ordered equality in 2003, openly gay and married state Senator Jared Barrios said in an emotional floor speech that, "You don't have to live next to us. You don't have to like us. We are only asking you today to end the debate so that we can sleep easily knowing that we will at least enjoy the same rights the rest of you have enjoyed for time immemorial." The action came 2 days after Massachusetts voters elected African-American Deval Patrick, a marriage equality supporter, as the state's first Democratic governor in 16 years. Democrats were also elected to all of the statewide offices.
Democrats Barney Frank of Massachusetts and Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin, the two openly lesbian members of the U.S. House of Representatives, easily won re-election. Out candidates also fared well in races at the state and local level. At least 67 candidates backed by the Gay and Lesbian Victory Fund won election, including 34 to state legislatures. Among them were Patricia Todd in Alabama and Kathy Webb in Arkansas, the first open lesbians or gays ever elected to public office in those states. Al McCaffrey became the first out candidate ever elected to the Oklahoma state legislature. Former state representative Ed Murray became the first openly gay state senator in Washington. And Jolie Justice was elected as the first ever openly lesbian or gay state senator in Missouri.
LGBT activists nationwide delighted in the defeat of several high-profile anti-queer incumbents, especially Republican Senator Rick Santorum of Pennsylvania, who lost by double digits to moderate Democrat Bob Casey. Santorum, the third-ranking Republican in the U.S. Senate, has been outspokenly anti-queer and a leading proponent of the so-called Federal Marriage Amendment. He made headlines 3 years ago when he warned that the Supreme Court ruling that struck down sodomy laws would lead to the legalization of man-on-dog sex. Equality advocates also cheered the defeat of anti-queer Republican Senator Mike DeWine in Ohio. His Democratic challenger, Congressman Sherrod Brown, has a strong record in support of LGBT rights. And incumbent Republican Senator George Allen of Virginia, who abandoned a moderate veneer in the past few years to support the Federal Marriage Amendment and oppose even employment protections and hate crime laws, lost to moderate Democrat Jim Webb in what turned out to be the final national vote count, giving Democrats control of the Senate.
Republicans in the House of Representatives, targeted by activists for their anti-queer records, were also sent packing by voters, including Congressman Clay Shaw of Florida and John Hostetler of Pennsylvania. But Marilyn Musgrave, the Colorado Republican who's been the lead House sponsor of the Federal Marriage Amendment, survived a strong Democratic challenger backed by LGBT groups.
A non-discrimination ordinance in the city of Ferndale, Michigan, finally passed. It was the third time since 1991 that a queer-inclusive human rights measure was on the ballot. And a city charter amendment banning bias based on sexual orientation and gender identity was approved by a wide margin in Corvallis, Oregon.
And finally, Kim Koko Iwamoto, a 38-year-old attorney, won election to the Hawaii State Board of Education, and according to national queer advocacy groups, has become the highest-ranking transgender elected official in U.S. history. She came in third in the race for three seats on the 14-member board, which oversees the island state's 285 public schools. Iwamoto, who was born on the island of Kauai and attended a Catholic boys' school in Honolulu, earned a law degree from the University of New Mexico. She was featured in a handbook on transgender policy there for her advocacy of special restroom facilities on the school's campus after she was repeatedly harassed for using the women's bathroom.
That's News Wrap for the week ending November 11th, 2006, written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Rick Watts.
And I'm Don Lupo.
This is Queer Voices. The Reverend Dr. Mel White is a speaker with a powerful and prophetic voice against the rise of Christian fundamentalism in America, something that we all know something about, I think. Also, the author of numerous books, including Stranger at the Gate, To Be Gay and Christian in America. He's also the co-founder and president of Soul Force Incorporated, which is an organization committed to ending religious-based bigotry against gays and lesbians in America. And I believe that Dr. White is with us on the phone at the moment.
I sure am. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. And Greg Chapman is here, too.
Hey, great. Hi, Greg.
Hi.
And my name is Glenn.
Hi, Glenn.
And Mel, I was in a bookstore in Dallas about a month ago, one of those sort of combination coffee shop bookstore variety novelty places, and went over to look at the books, and your book jumped off the shelf at me. You'll be glad to know that.
I'm glad to know that.
It says in big bold print, Religion Gone Bad. And then it's got sort of an image of barbed wire across it. The Hidden Dangers of the Christian Right. And then I picked it up and I read on the back about Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell and this frightening, I guess, fundamentalist plan to reconstruct America into a theocracy. I've been reading through the book. I'll confess, you know, that I didn't get all the way through.
I actually did read the whole thing.
Good, good. Yeah. It's captivating reading.
It is very captivating reading, and it is actually pretty difficult to read. It's pretty frightening. I mean, you basically lay out that there's a blueprint that's I think you called it the Glen Eyrie Protocol, that it's been laid out to basically wage war against people who are GLBT.
Absolutely. Yeah. We found that in 1994, 52 or 53 of these anti-gay fundamentalist Christian leaders met in a castle in Glenary in a secret meeting. And in this last year, we found that somehow somebody had recorded those sessions and had dropped them into the Tufts University archives. And we downloaded them, we transcribed them, and we found the plan that the Christian fundamentalists have for gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people. And as you say, it's a scary plan.
They always accuse us of having an agenda, but of course yeah. They're the ones who have the agenda.
Yeah, I say we couldn't agree on an agenda if we had to. Although we do have an agenda, and that is to simply get the civil rights to all Americans, right?
Well, yeah, exactly.
So what exactly is their agenda? I mean, how far are they prepared to go?
Well, the irony is that behind their agenda is this basic belief that because homosexuality is a, quote, sin that interrupts the order of nature, that if this country accepts homosexuals in any way as a protected minority, then God will remove his hand of blessing and this nation will spiral into oblivion. So their goal is to keep us from being recognized in any way. That's hate crime legislation, that's the army, military service, that's marriage ordination, that's adoption, foster care. I mean, they are out to simply dehumanize us, to demonize us, to deny us our rights, and to drive us back into our closets or worse. And little by little, they're doing it.
I think the question is why, because there are other sins other than homosexuality.
Yeah, I think this is a convenient one. First of all, I know these guys well enough to know that they are sincere, and once we think they're phony, we're in trouble because they really believe this stuff. They're also using it. They know that demographically, this country is still perplexed over same-sex orientation, and they don't... they find it an easy fear and loathing technique to talk about gay people. When you say why, I think it's a very sophisticated question, and the answer is simply that because when God created the humankind, God meant for man to be in charge, and I might add white men from America, and that women would be way down on that chain. And so when gay men come along, they simply destroy all those sexual gender stereotypes, and they undermine what they believe is the family and what the family should be. So somehow they've got into their heads that we're also close to being recognized, and it's the sin that is a problem, but it's also the fact that America is about to recognize us, at least we feel so, and they're really unhappy about that.
And it's also the sort of Jungian projection thing.
You're not kidding, Jungian. That's a good one. Yeah, they these guys are so intent that what scares me most right now is that because they lost, quote, this election, that they're going to simply go away, that they've lost their power. And in fact, they were simply unamused about Bush months before this election, and about this war, and about the economy, and about the way Republicans are spending money. So they simply held back. Watch them now. They're going to go for the 2008 in a big way, and we've got to be very careful not to let them win.
I remember from your book you had a quote from Falwell that said, it said, vote Christian. It doesn't take a lick of sense to know what that means. Any Demi knows what it means to vote Christian. I mean, obviously, he means vote Republican. And I kind of wonder why there hasn't been any issues raised about separation of church and state with so many of the fundamentalist churches becoming intensely political.
Well, I think the IRS is not just missing a beat. I think that the IRS is being used by the powers that be, now that they are Republicans, to chasten and to harass churches like my own home church in Pasadena, All Saints Pasadena, where the Episcopal rector simply said that the president isn't really telling us the true consequences of this war, and now the IRS is suing to take away their nonprofit status, whereas I sit in Falwell's church on Sunday and hear him say George Bush was put in office because God put him there, and that if you disagree with George Bush, you disagree with God, and no IRS people around. So do you tell me how that works? If it isn't the government on the side of the right, I don't know what it would be.
You mentioned at the end of the book, you sort of give a call to arms for GLDB persons and their allies, and you speak of a relentless, nonviolent resistance. What does that kind of look like in everyday life?
Well, the first thing, we can't start demonizing them, and I've already done that a little on this program. They're just our fellow Americans. They're our dads and moms and grandpas and grandmas. They're not devils, and they really believe this untruth about us. So to see that they are Americans and that they have won, they won this last election, the election before this one, fair and square, and that they have the right to make their opinions known. At the same time, as gay and lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people, as queers, we have to confront the untruth wherever we see it. So we want to do it so that we don't hate them, but we want to undermine the lies they tell with truth. And I tell you, the only real answer is to come out. The only way people change about this issue from an anti-gay to a pro-gay is to know us. That's why Gary and I moved to Lynchburg. We've gone to Jerry's church now for 3 years, Falwell's church, and we stand up and protest silently when he preaches against us. But after 3 years and about 4 months, the dean of their seminary asked me to speak, and I'm having lunch with him on Friday this week. So I think as they watch us, then they hear Jerry saying these demonizing things about us, and it doesn't make sense.
Good. Now, that is pretty amazing. So,
well, Mel, one of the things that caught me right away when I looked at the back of your book, Religion Gone Bad, is that it says that you were a ghostwriter for Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson.
We all have our past.
In a former life, yeah.
My agent was Irving Swifty Lazar. And I had a doctorate in religion, and my father was a Democratic mayor of Santa Cruz, California, and I came from a very progressive evangelical family. But because I had a doctorate, and because they needed their biographies written, and because I was in the closet thinking that I was sick and sinful, I put my kids through college working to write these biographies of these guys. Now I look back, and I think, I'm embarrassed and ashamed that I flew in there and got their stories and wrote them up, but at the same time, I wouldn't know these guys as well as I do if I hadn't had opportunities. So maybe it's a rationalization, or maybe it's that God has a sense of humor.
You talk in your book about turning away from people and organizations who don't fully embrace people who are GLBT as part of that nonviolent resistance. But on the other hand, isn't it important to sort of stand your ground, to be an example, as you said?
That's really wise for you to say that there's two sides to that issue. For example, religion, churches. If a church is harassing and hammering away at a gay person's own spirituality, crippling his spirit, crippling his self-assuredness, you know, that person needs to get out of there. But if he's tough or she's tough and can stay in there and bear witness to the truth that I am God's child too, that God created me and loves me exactly as I am, if that person can stay and not be brought down by it, what I'm afraid of is that there's so many closeted gay and lesbian people who are staying in their churches and are getting this terrible blast of untruth daily, and it really cripples their spirits. I had a person send a check for $10,000 about 6-7 weeks ago to SoulForce and then kill himself. He'd only read about us on the internet and wanted to encourage us to go on because his church, his priest, his family had been so negative he couldn't live with it anymore. And I can't tell you how many people like that I've buried. So I hate risking them to be justice activists until they're really ready.
And there's also kind of those gray areas where you get mixed messages. I mean, my rector favors same-sex blessings. He favors gay bishops in person, but you know, he voted against the elevation of Gene Robinson to in the Episcopal Church to bishop because he was openly gay, because he didn't want conservatives to be tested so directly. So you get, you know, you get confusing messages about, you know, are they really supporting you or are they not?
Well, that's the irony right now. Progressives, you know, like perhaps the most popular book out now about this issue is God's Politics by Jim Wallace, and he's a progressive evangelical who says that gays ought to have all the rights that anybody else has, but let's not talk about it now because it's too divisive. It's that kind of mixed message that you're talking about. And we have a program at SOFORS called Faithful Dissenters, where when a pastor shows his true colors or her true colors like this and votes against us, then we simply put a note in the offering plate and say, we're not going to give any more money to this church until you start supporting us in every way. And I tell you, you'd be called in to see the rector really fast. Better be prepared to tell him what you think.
You are listening to Queer Voices, and Greg and I are talking to Mel White, author of Religion Gone Bad and Strangers at the Gate, and Mel and his partner are the founders of Soul Force.
I'm curious what you think makes a fundamentalist, because it's certainly not taking the Bible literally. I mean, they're only looking at certain, you know, pieces that they pull out and ignoring others. I mean, what really makes...
Oh, right you are. We call them selective literalists.
Selective literalists.
Yeah, they select what they want to be literal about and leave the rest. But the fact is, at the heart of fundamentalism is this literal Bible. Because it's a kind of mentality that says, I know what this book says. And if you don't agree with me, you're not even worthy of being a Christian, let alone an American, because this is, of course, a Christian nation, quote, quote. So that a fundamentalist... There's several wonderful short definitions, but one I like best is it's orthodoxy gone cultic. It's, you know, it's the Christian world gone nuts. And periodically the Islamic world goes nuts and the Jewish world goes nuts. And in the last 35 years, Karen Armstrong's book, The Battle for God, traces how these great religious traditions have gone fundamentalist and have these great pockets of literalists who, if it says gays should be killed, they say, okay, let's kill them. I was on a radio broadcast in Seattle where a minister said, reading Leviticus 20, a man who sleeps with another man is an abomination, should be executed. And he says, it means you should be killed. And I said, who should do the killing? You church folks? And he said, no, that's the civil authority's job. That's why we need to get more good men of God elected into government. And by then I was swallowing hard and silent. And he said, I know that must be hard for you to hear, Dr. White, but God said it first, and it's simply our job to obey. I think that's the extremist fundamentalist. The scripture is clear. A man who sleeps with another man is an abomination and should be executed. I'm hoping that they will stay with the selective literalism that says we're abominations. But I have this terrible feeling that if we get really into power, and if we have another terrorist kind of attack and this country starts breaking down, I think they might go the whole way. There's some of them who are insisting on it now.
You know, Mel, whenever somebody trots that line out in front of me, I like to also point out that in Leviticus, in a verse very close to that one, it says that it's also an abomination to wear clothing woven from two different kinds of cloth, for example, a cotton polyester blend.
Well, no gay person would wear that anyway.
No, that's right.
Well, it also says you can't play with the skin of a pig, and there goes football.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact is they are ignoring, like you said, they are ignoring not just other significant passages, but they're ignoring the whole truth of the Bible. The Bible is the story in the Jewish and Christian traditions of a God who loved the world and is constantly seeking to renew and redeem its people. And that's what that story is about. The Jewish prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Jesus, Paul. These people were saying, God loves this world, God loves you, God created you. They come along where Jesus was trying to make, you know, welcome outcasts in, and these fundamentalists are trying turn us into outcasts. And it's my favorite bumper sticker is Jesus is coming again, and boy, is he pissed. I really believe that. I think that this breaks the heart of God.
What's interesting is, you know, people like Ted Haggard, who recently was exposed, you know, he was head of one of the big evangelical organizations and big of a head of the megachurch in Colorado. People like him who are secretly gay, they experience being gay in a wholly different way than people who are okay with it and are out openly. I mean, the way he experienced it was something dark and something he had to do in secret, and he had no emotional attachment to it. And so I find that kind of interesting that these fundamentalists who are actually gay, what they understand as being gays is a completely different experience than what, say, someone like me or the other people here would see it.
Yeah, isn't it sad? And especially when he came out with his confession that this was a dark and dirty secret. Imagine all the closeted gay kids in his 14,000-member church who hears the pastor again stereotyping from his own life, caricaturing us as dark and evil. You know, I want to say to Haggard, hey, be like Jim McGreevy, the governor of New Jersey. Accept your sexual orientation now. You have been exposed. Why don't you do the good thing? Accept your sexual orientation. Find yourself a partner. Live a gay life. And instead of this grim kind of, I'm going to get over this, because we know he won't. And in the process, he'll grow more and more afraid and more guilty. And in the long haul, bring down a whole lot of people with him.
And he'll just project more and more and do more and more of the same sorts of things that he's been doing.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. He'll return right to the trough. I mean, when you love a man, or when you're a woman, you love a woman, it's so much more than about sex. It's about human intimacy, you know? Gary and I have been together 25 years now. We're lying side by side in a hotel bed in Charleston, South Carolina, talking to you. And I think, what would I do if Gary wasn't in my bed for 25 years? I mean, when I come home to Gary Nixon, whether I kid him about how tired of I am talking about sex all over the country when I'm especially not getting any. But the fact is, you know, we get so tired doing this but there's another kind of an intimacy, you know, just being together. And I think Ted Haggard and these guys who think it's about sex and sneak away, they're missing the joy of being a gay or lesbian person and the joy of being together with a gay or lesbian person and loving him and feeling close to him. But I want Ted Haggard to know what it means to be gay, that God created him gay, and that he's got to get out of this fundamentalist stuff.
And the joy of giving yourself the permission to be who you are.
Yes, thank you. Oh, yes.
Yeah. Living with integrity.
Yeah.
And after all, Mel, isn't being married about not having sex? I mean, isn't that the whole...
is there sex after marriage? Yeah, I go around the country saying, you know, when you go to bed with and make love to a man or to a woman, this is part of God's plan for your life. It's not something to do in the back of bookstores or, you know, hidden away.
Well, yeah,
this
exactly.
is something joyful.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Mel, I must say you gave me a scare because, I mean, reading through your book, it would make a conspiracy theorist blush. But you were in a great position on the inside to really know this stuff.
Yeah, it's footnoted, friend.
And what do we do now? Where do we go from here?
Well, we were on a, you know, when Rick Santorum went down, my heart went up. Because he was one of the real homophobes, bringing the whole Catholic notion that we're intrinsically evil and objectively disordered into the Senate. And he was thoroughly repudiated. And I love that, the idea that someone from San Francisco could be Speaker of the House. All of those things are the good side. But the bad side is we lost 7 of those 8 amendments. And that whenever the rhetoric about gay marriage being sick and sinful, and that it's a threat to families and a threat to children, whenever that rhetoric goes down, whether we win the amendment or lose it, we lose it. And so right now, again, the atmosphere has been poisoned by untruth. And the only way to turn that around is to say to our workers, our fellow workers, our moms, our dads, our grandparents, our uncles, our aunts, hey, I'm a gay person. And I really resent you're saying these evil things about us because You know we're not that way. So for me, the answer is coming out, friend. I don't think we'll ever out-organize them, but we sure could out-integrity them.
And what part does Soul Force play in that?
Well, Soul Force is just a kind of a loose organization. We've trained probably 10,000 people of faith across the nation, and pagans and atheists and various other allies who realize that most of the oppression we face now is religion-based, and that religion-based oppression has tragic consequences in the lives of our brothers and sisters, and that we need to stand up to it. So when Gary and I hear Falwell doing it again, we stand up in silent protest. And, you know, at first the church just was just stunned by our standing up and protesting, but right now they wait for it, and they're beginning to notice. And so for me, just, it's so much more fun to take a stand for our rights and against the untruth than it is to sit there and suffer.
And you have a website, right?
Yeah, soulforce.org, or our youth website now, qualityride.com. You've seen our kids in buses going across the country facing up to these Christian schools. Now they're in a right to serve campaign, closing down recruitment centers. And so you find a whole youth movement, and for young people who would like to plug in, the Soulforce page or the Quality Ride page, both will give them ways to become a part of that.
And do you have some recommended reading material listed on your website, such as your books?
Yeah, we do. We have lots of good stuff. And right now I'm out on the road. This is the 33rd city in 39 days or something. I'm bleary-eyed. But tonight in a Barnes & Noble, I said, just go to the bookstore now and find books that really help you understand that you're okay. And we list those books, a lot of them, on the webpage. Stranger at the Gate is just my story of saying how long it took me to come to terms with the fact that my sexual orientation was a gift. So, yeah, there's good resources there. We also have a book called What the Bible Says and Doesn't Say About Homosexuality that they can get free by just asking for it online. It's a 32-page book that really answers those pesky biblical questions.
You know, and you mentioned Strangers at the Gate and your roadmap to coming out and coming to terms with yourself. And what's interesting is for a lot of GLBT people, it did take a long time. And so that should encourage, you know, everyone not to just demonize people who can't quite get it yet.
Good statement. That's so important.
So, Mel White and your partner, Gary Nixon, reach over and give him a hug for us, because the two of you together are the blessing in all of this. And your book, Strangers at the Gate, and the new book, Religion Gone Bad. For Greg Chapman, I'm Glenn Holt, and this is Queer Voices. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling.
is that?
We don't know. We don't know. For some reason, we don't know who that is.
That's JD isn't here to tell
us. JD isn't
what
here. Usually we have that information,
time, yes.
But we apparently don't.
But we have Jeff Reed here.
Well, tonight we're talking about the election, and quite a Tuesday it was. The previous Monday, a week ago today, when David Elliott made the predictions, we were all holding our breath because the two elections previous that, he made those predictions and they didn't come true.
Nothing came to happen, like he said, but this time he was on target.
Well, and actually I think it even went better than we thought in the national elections and on the local elections. Unfortunately, on the state and county elections, they didn't quite go as well, but then again, we weren't really pushing for that. Now, for a disclaimer here, of course, I am on the board of the GLBT Political Caucus.
And I am president of the GLBT Political Caucus.
And Jeff doesn't need to do a disclaimer because he is a guest.
Hi, I'm a guest. I don't need to do a disclaimer.
But Jeff is on the board of the Houston HERA organization.
Houston Equal Rights Alliance, that's correct. I'm the treasurer.
So I guess we can talk a little bit about, you know, what part our community had in this between caucus and HERA.
Well, so HERA partnered with the caucus, and very early on we had talked to Ellen Cohen, and we were very, very interested in doing everything we could as political action committees to help Ellen get elected and to remove Martha Wong from office, simply because Martha has not represented the GLBT people in her district very well, and since she has a big chunk of the Montrose and really one of the most high populations of GLBT people in any district in Texas, it seemed quite ridiculous that she should represent us poorly.
Well, and if we go back in history a little bit, that district was split in half when it was Deborah Danberg's district before that, and that was part of all of Tom DeLay's plan of first, let's redistrict Texas, and then we can redistrict the congressional districts in Texas.
And it worked very well in the short term.
He did, yes. Yes.
Unfortunately, when you redistrict, you end up basically moving razor-thin margins around, hoping that you can, you know, win 51%, 49% elections in a lot of places instead of 60%, 40% elections in a few places. And when there's a reorganization, that means you lose a bunch of seats, which is what happened on Tuesday.
Well, and the other thing is demographics change. People move around, and suddenly what looked like a very secure area can turn. I think of Hubert Vaux, for that matter.
Absolutely true. You know, Hubert Vaux's district is a district, for those of you who don't know, it is out west near Bissonnette and the Beltway. And a lot of displaced people from Katrina moved out there, and not necessarily all of them registered to vote, but certainly many of them did. And so there was a large influx of poor people of color who, presumably, if you look at demographics, are probably going to be voting Democratic. And, you know, last time in 2004, he won by the quote is no fewer than 16 votes, which is about as close as elections get. And this time he won by a substantial margin. I think it was 8%.
No. Something like that. I think it was 57%, wasn't it?
It was like 57-43, something
like
that.
But the difference is it also that in that vote, and I was looking at the demographics of the area, it had shifted a great deal over to the non-white demographic.
Oh, yeah.
And since Hubert Vaux is a Vietnamese, came over here with nothing and has built a life for he and his family as really the American, you know, quintessential American story.
He has a great American dream story. And to point out to the listeners who may not know, Hubert Vaux is in a district which did not vote the way that we would have liked them to have voted on Proposition 2. Namely, they voted as a district to add discrimination to the Constitution to forbid same-sex people from marrying. But Hubert recorded a vote, a very vocal no vote on that in the House, even though he didn't have to. He knew it was going to pass the House, whether he voted yes or no, and he could have easily done the politically correct thing for him to do, which would have been to sit on his hands and shut up and do what his district was going to do. And, you know, his opponent, Talmadge Heflin, tried to use that vote against him, and he failed.
Well, I think the thing to remember is that he just did the right thing. And if you ask him about why he did it, that's what he says.
Absolutely. You know, he's a great representative, and he's one of those few politicians who, when he talks to you, you get the real feeling that you're talking to a real person, and you're not, you don't feel like you're talking to a book full of talking points.
Right. Well, let's go back to Ellen now. She won by a sizable margin, too.
She won by a larger margin, and, you know, in no small part due to the fact that the GLBT community mobilized like they have never mobilized before in Texas anywhere to try to help her get elected, because she is a great candidate. I heard time and again out at the polls on Election Day people saying, I really am excited to vote for Ellen Cohen. It isn't just that I don't like Martha Wong, although many of them didn't, including many Republicans who made it clear to me that they were Republicans and they did not like Martha Wong, but there were many people who were really, really excited about Ellen because she is such a great speaker. She is such a great moral, deeply caring person that you talk to her and you know that no matter what comes up, she's going to do the right thing and she's going to represent the people of 134 very well.
Well, let's talk a little bit about how this all happened. I mean, it wasn't just a matter of showing up Election Day and she got elected because...
That's a very good point. These elections are an enormous amount of hard work. There's study after study, and I've said this here at KPFT before, and I'll say it again. The thing that gets people to vote the way you want them to vote is you have to physically go face-to-face to them and ask them to vote the way you want them to vote. It's the hard, difficult truth, because it is not a matter of money, it's a matter of time and effort and people. So it's getting up at 8 a.m. every Saturday morning for months on end and going out and knocking on strangers' doors and sharing your passion for the issues and your passion for the candidate with people at their doorstep. And it's uncomfortable and it's hot and it's thirsty work and nobody really wants to do it, but it's absolutely essential to the process. And the GLBT community in District 134 and in other districts as well came together and stood up in a way that really we have never stood up before, and we had the guts to go out there and knock on people's doors day in, day out, Saturdays in the rain, Tuesdays in the heat, and ask people at their doorstep, who are you going to vote for? What do you know about the candidates? Do you know about Ellen Cohen? And really helped Ellen in the best possible way, which is boots on the ground.
Yeah. I think another thing to point out, too, that the opposition candidates, Martha Wong and Tammy Chaplin, both gay-baited in their TV advertising, their mail-outs, their robocalls. In both races, they played the gay card and lost.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I think one of the overarching take-home messages of Tuesday's election, you look at Arizona, for the first time, we won as a community on a marriage issue in a statewide election. That is huge. Furthermore, if you look at the margins on the other propositions, which went the wrong way in states like South Dakota, we actually did better than we anticipated. The power of the gay bait is waning. And with Karl Rove's great failure last Tuesday, and it certainly was his failure, there is going to be less and less of this because it's less and less effective. And it may sound counterintuitive, but I say bring it on. If they want to bring on the gay bait, go right ahead, because it doesn't work anymore and they're going to lose.
Well, I think it turns off that independent voter, the one in the middle who leans neither left nor right, just has a sense of fairness in themselves, and they hear that stuff and they don't like negative advertising anyway.
Well, and I think more than that, people are beginning to realize the power of the gay marriage argument, that it was going to destroy society if you allow gay people to be married, rests on the fact that people don't know what's going to happen. It's a fear-based argument, and when you see people have been getting married in Massachusetts for who knows how long now, you know, the average voter is like, gosh, when did that start? I don't know. People have been getting married in Europe for years now. It isn't the end of the world. Marriage isn't being destroyed. Dogs and cats aren't living together in harmony. You know, it's not like pieces of the sky aren't falling. The sun hasn't exploded yet. So people are going, oh, okay, well, I guess it's really not that bad. Let's move on. And so they're moving on from gay marriage. And, you know, in some ways, it's good for us because now we can move past that as a gay baiting issue. But in some ways, I think it's maybe a little bit bad for us because we're not going to have the national stage to talk about our issues as much. And that means, you know, with this win, we're going to have to move forward and try harder to get a positive message out there because, you know, for better or worse, people are not going to be paying so much attention to the gay marriage argument.
Well, and in future elections, and what's the thrust of community now? What are they? What is the community as a whole, the GLBT community, looking to do? Since gay marriage is really off the table, what is it?
Well,
I
don't, you know, I don't want to paint too rosy a picture. It isn't off the table. We're going to continue to have to fight these things.
Well, I'm talking about in Texas,
and they will come up. But right, so in terms of the future, where I see elections going, there's an important statistic that came out of Tuesday. In the Bush-Kerry election, Bush carried an enormous percentage of the Hispanic vote for a Republican. He carried 40-some percent, and Kerry carried 50-some percent. And that was a huge shift, and that was all these conservative, social conservative voters moving to Bush. In this last election, because of the immigration debacle, the absolute train wreck that was Karl Rove's immigration policy, something like 77% of Hispanics voted Democrat. And so we are seeing a huge realignment in terms of the Hispanic vote coming back to the Democratic Party. And as the GLBT community, we, I think, need to look past ourselves, past our own issues, and do what we can to partner with other communities. That means partnering with the African-American community, particularly on AIDS issues, partnering with the Hispanic community on immigration issues. These are things that are relevant to us, so it's in our self-serving self-interest, but it's also coming together with these other oppressed communities and making a bigger, broader, stronger coalition where we can move forward faster because we're all working together.
Is there, I understand now we're going to have a special election in May to replace Sugula Gibbs because she's moved on. Is there any game plan for community toward that?
What I will say, you know, the GLBT political caucus, that's and endorses candidates, and I know of at least two candidates. I won't say any names because I don't know the status of whether they've announced or not, who have approached the caucus and have talked about screening with the caucus. But, you know, the caucus will go through its process. They will vet and endorse the candidates. They will endorse a candidate, and then, as always, here in Houston, we will all get behind the caucus's endorsement and work to do what we can to get the right person for Houston and the right person for GLBT, for the GLBT community in Houston, elected to the city council.
One thing, let's turn back to the national appearance. What do you expect from Congress, the new Congress?
Well, I think the thing that you're going to see from the new Congress is the Democrats will want to take the lead that they have now, and they're going to want to build on that. And the way that I believe that they are going to try to build is they're going to move to the center. If you look at what happened on Tuesday, you can think of it as a realignment to the center, where really far-right conservative candidates like Rick Santorum's a perfect example, got lopped off in Pennsylvania, a relatively progressive blue state, and he got replaced with a more progressive Democrat. And so I think you'll see the Democrats try to become a moderating force. Doesn't necessarily mean they're going to be pushing GLBT issues, and certainly Iraq is looming large. So look for more moderation from Congress. Look for a lot of talk about bipartisanship. Whether or not people are actually working together, it remains to be seen. And certainly there's going to be a lot of talk on Iraq and how to get from where we are to somewhere better.
Okay, what does what can the average person out there that's listening to us, who's excited about what happened in the election and, you know, going forward, what can they do to be part of this process of making the changes in our community and in the political environment?
The best thing that Queer Voices listeners can do is go to hglbtpc.org, which is the caucus's website, and they can look up when the general meeting is, and it's the first Wednesday of the month at the community center at 7 p.m. That's when it always is. And show up there and, you know, listen to the speaker and meet the people and just get in tune with the broader political gay community and figure out where to go from there. Yeah,
the next meeting is December 6th at 7 p.m. So those that might be interested, come out and become part of it. Join the caucus or volunteer just to do any part of the campaigning.
Absolutely. And I have to say, right now is a great time to be part of the caucus. We have had a huge win with all the hard work we did for Ellen, and it feels great to be on the winning team when we've worked so hard.
I thought it was interesting that quote Martha Wong when asked, is the, well, I can't remember exactly, but the gays got me.
Well, and if you're a complete political junkie, there's a conference happening later this week in Houston. The Victory Fund is doing a national conference. Actually, it's an international conference that was previously called the Organization of Elected and or Appointed Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, Transgendered Officials. And now the Victory Fund is sort of taking that conference over. And I believe you could still possibly get into it. Go to thevictoryfund.org. There's also some events that happen around the conference, or you can just show up for a day, but you do have to register beforehand. It's happening at the JW Marriott Hotel on Westheimer, just outside the Loop in the Galleria area, and it sounds like it's going to be a fabulous conference, including Mr. Dean is going to be here,
yes.
Barney Frank is going to be here, and of course, you know, Anise Parker and Sue Lovell from our community will be part of that conference, but it's also sort of a, you know, what's going on in the community in getting people elected, and they're actually doing a training institute, which I believe that's probably already closed.
Yeah,
and,
the training is closed.
Intensive training.
Yes, intensive training, and I'll be part of that next week. This is KPFT Houston. And thank you, Jeff. Thank you for coming and being with Jeff with Hera.
Well, thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Thank you very much.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Belinsky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
Notions seem like jokes to us today. They are sitting in our capitals and the White House and the Supreme Court. They'll be voting on our lives. If we don't stop them now, our freedom will not long survive. No going back, back to those lousy days when men were really masters and women were. And build a world that's based on true democracy. And build a world that's based on true equality. Person.
With Anne Feeney with Days of the Theocracy.
And this is Jack Belinsky, and on the line with me is Frieda Mock, and she is director of a new movie called Wrestling with Angels. Welcome.
Thank you, Jack. Nice to be on your program.
Well, we're glad to have you. And the film just opened up this Friday, playing downtown at the Angelica Theater, which is a wonderful theater, plays a lot of independent films. And why don't you tell us a little bit, and you're the director, right?
Yes, I'm the director, wow, producer, and writer of Wrestling with Angels, playwright Tony Kushner. And for many of your readers, you're probably very familiar with his incredible, epic play.
Absolutely. HBO did a fabulous job on it, played down here at the Alley Theater here in Houston, and it's been staged all over the world.
Absolutely. And, of course, it was then Angels in America was made into a wonderful HBO film, 6 hours instead of 7 hours.
Yes.
That director Mike Nichols, you know, pulled together an amazing cast. And Meryl Streep and Emma Thompson, Al Pacino, and Jeffrey Wright from the original play, Broadway play, and many others. And portions of that are in selections of scenes from the movie are in the film on Tony Kushner, as are some selections from the Broadway play of Angels in America. So
it got a very good review in the Chronicle this week also.
I'm very happy about the Chronicle review. I think he really, really appreciated the film, and I appreciate his writing. So I think basically audiences, when they see, take a journey, basically the story takes place between, looks at Tony's work and life in a three-year time span from 9/11 to the 2004 election. And the film started when he was doing his next big play after Angels, which is Homebody Cobble. It takes the audience on a journey into his creativity and the mystery of how one becomes a playwright, but also one sees him very active with his community. There's a great deal of laughter and crying, and in the best sense of the word, when people see the film.
So you basically followed him around, this took a long time then to put this film together.
Yes, it was a three-year production.
Wow.
You know, all over the country, because I'm in the L.A. area and he's in New York, but he is, you know, performing, rehearsing, speaking, because he's highly, highly welcome a speaker at high schools and colleges and community settings. He gives a lot of his time, you know, to whether it's to the Jewish community, to the LGBT community, to students. So I had spent a lot of time on a plane, so to speak, catching
yes
up with him. And then it took us a year to put it together, and it's been out in festivals since it debuted in Sundance. It's been playing to packed audiences in a lot of different places, and it just opened a month ago in New York as a kickoff for its commercial run.
So tell us a little bit about Tony's creative process. I mean, he's a genius in what he's done.
Yes, I think that's as much as I can divine, you know, the mystery,
right,
creativity, but
right,
to me, that's what one of the aspects of the film is, to look at what are the forces, and one can see very much, well, one, he, of course, is very interested in the world around him, and he reads a great deal, and is just engaged, you know, with the world, but ideas just come to mind, and I think so. You'll see, I think, from the film how connections are made. I mean, there's an amazing scene in which a month before the invasion of Iraq, Tony is speaking with, you know, in a large anti-war demonstration, basically, in February the 15th, before the war started, and that's in New York. And afterwards, he says he was quite depressed by
sure
what he felt. And
yeah,
so out of that depression, he stayed up the entire night and wrote furiously a new play, the first act, which became what they called the Laura Bush play. And the connection between that is he remembered having read that Laura Bush loved Dostoevsky, the brothers Karamazov, and I think he found a connection because he too, Tony, loves the brothers K. So, you know, you begin to see how things are connected, but the moment of writing that comes out of that scene, you see him, you know, speaking out against the war, and then the next moment you see a month later the film, the play Laura Bush has performed in Providence, Rhode Island. So I think for the audience, they'll see almost a direct connection of how thinking and reading and writing and doing something became a catalyst for a play to pop out. But certainly Angels in America, one can see he talks about how you know, certainly he was very, he had just come out in the early 80s and the AIDS crisis was blooming, and he was very much aware of how little it was being done. You know?
Yes.
And so he really wrote that as a response to the government's inaction. But also, the character of Roy Cohn came out of just the fact that his father had given him a book when he was in high school about Roy Cohn. And that just stayed with him.
Yeah.
You know? And then, of course, he talks about having how people ask, well, what's the play about? He said, well, it's about Roy Cohn and gay Mormons. And he remembers seeing these cute guys in white shirts, he calls them, you know, at the subway when he was leaving his apartment in Brooklyn. And these were young Mormon men passing out their booklets, you know. So it's just interesting how things connect. But actually what's particularly interesting with film, if you want to understand how what influenced him, he said he had a dream. And out of that, he had that dream in which the angel comes through crashing through the ceiling. There was a dream that in that scene.
Yes,
most
yes,
of us remember
yes.
At the end of second
right.
act. So I think for many of the people who see the film, that they really get a feeling about just how what influences be you know in his case the playwright to do what he does. But also, I think the influence of his Jewish heritage is very prominent. You know, that sort of positive belief that things will progress, and the belief that things will get better. You know, that you work together as a collective to make things, to overcome injustice. So that's
right.
very much how he grew up, I think.
And a lot of us in our community feel the same way, or hope have that same hope.
I think so too, and I think it's by being. You know, joined as brothers and sisters. You know, I think it's very much something that I think has brought great progress for the, as you say, especially the LGBT community. And I think he was definitely influenced by the Stonewall. You know, that legacy. You know, and really feels he stands on the shoulders of those who came before him, and therefore feels the responsibility of himself speaking out and being. Doing his part, you know.
And yes, the HBO rendition of Angels in America was just absolutely incredible.
Fantastic.
And the fact that, you know, as much as, you know, writing a play is fabulous, getting it out into the, you know, into the hinterlands like HBO is able to do, or any type of mass media like that, really gets that story told.
Absolutely. And at the same time, you know, his plays are, you know, particularly Angels. Someone just told me the other day she saw a high school performance of the first part one, you know, and it was good. You know, that it's great that because the language and the stories and the characters of Angels are so compelling that, you know, it's not that daunting, perhaps, to have it, you know, rehearsed and played in a small setting, you know, so...
Yes. There's nothing like theater. We're talking to Frieda Mock, who is the director of Wrestling with Angels, which is a documentary on Tony Kushner. Why did you decide to do this film?
I was drawn to Tony's voice, really, his social political sense of looking at the world. And I, of course, was very aware of his distinguished work with Angels in America. Actually, when I started the play, I hadn't seen it, nor had I read it, but I had heard him speak. And his speaking, if you haven't ever had him, you know, seen or heard him, it was a one-minute speech he gave on receiving an honorary doctorate. It was brilliant. It was funny, generous-spirited, very socially and politically, you know, wonderful, and inspiring. So that just, you know, stayed with me. But particularly when I read that he was writing his second play on Afghanistan, that sort of just... was a kind of a tipping point. And I said, gee, it would be interesting to do a film about a person who's particularly engaged with the political, social parts of our world,
yes.
both globally and nationally.
Yes.
And see how he does it through the form of a play as opposed to a sculpture, let's say. I rather enjoy doing films about artists, you know, but artists who have a particular social, political kind of sensibility in their work. And the last big film I did was, the preceding this was on Maya Lin, the woman who designed the Vietnam Veterans Memorial.
Oh, yeah.
And that was, you know, had a similar resonance, always has layers of interesting and understanding, you know. So I felt Tony's work really had compelling, you know, fascinating aspects.
Well, and it's so nice now that documentaries are getting to be seen more.
Absolutely.
You know, with the 500 channels on cable TV, there's a little bit more of a chance to see something you wouldn't seen before, and or things like, not that I'm promoting Netflix, I mean,
yeah.
These things are, you know, you can't always find them at your video store, even in a major city.
Exactly. At the same time, theater moviegoers have discovered documentary films.
Yes.
It's a great, entertaining,
yes.
and engaging yes. art, you know, experience. And that's where we're thrilled that it's playing at the Angelica, you know, for the week or so. And that I think, particularly just like plays are a great collective experience, so can movies be, you know.
Yes.
I think the Tony Kushner movie at the Angelica is actually very funny and serious, and ultimately, you know, people laugh and they cry in a good sense. You know?
So
and
what
feel inspired.
So, yes, so what is next for you?
I'm doing a couple of things, about another artist and music and, you know, women. It's a conglomerate of topics. Yeah. But this has been a great, wonderful story to tell. I mean, Tony's...
Yes, absolutely. And I have to apologize, and I told you I didn't get to see it yet, and I desperately do want to see it because it sounds like it's fabulous. And certainly you did your job of getting that word out, which I appreciate.
Well, I thought your community... I was in your community about 7 years ago with another film that played the Angelica. It was not about... It was about fighter pilots mm-hmm. surviving as POWs, and kind of a different... But it's, you know, it's a different kind of story, but at the same time, it had the humanity that I think you find in Tony's work. So I visited, you know, Houston a lot because one of the major persons in the film was an attorney in Houston. You know. And but I'm very aware of what, you know, I was particularly thinking this film might be an inspiring film for the LGBT community because of the recent, you know, issue over the landscaper, you know, and we read it in L.A. and I saw it in the New York Times about, you know, a business saying that it would not do work for homosexuals, you know, and I think if anything someone says...
yes, isn't that strange
this
how that...
Film,
yes.
Yeah, people say this film makes you proud to be gay.
Yes,
besides
yes.
everything else, be proud to be an American, basically. You know. But it's really a film that I think makes you very, very... proud to be who you are.
Well, great. It is great talking to you, and I wish you the best of luck on this film.
Thank you,
Jeff. And just to remind everybody, it's playing downtown at the Angelica Theater, and it's called
Wrestling with Angels.
Is it
playwright Tony Kushner. Yeah, so
absolutely.
A big, long title.
And it's only going to play for this week, is that?
Yes.
Okay. So, and then hopefully it will be available after it makes its run on home video.
Yes, way down the line, it'll definitely be available.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, great. Thank you very much.
And thank you, Jack, for doing your good work, and thank you for having me on the show.
Great. You're listening to Queer Voices.
This is Queer Voices.
About same-sex marriage, do you get sick to your gut? I mean, two people who want to commit to a stable, monogamous, lifelong relationship, what are they, nuts? It's unnatural. Oh, a man must never lie with a person who is a guy. He should only lie to his wife. The Bible is clear. We're defenders of marriage. It's three buttons too. We'll raise our double standard and see who salutes. Defenders of marriage, defending the institution. Married. Now every time we think about same-sex parents, oh my gosh, we exclaim.
And that was another little bit of Ann Feeney with the Defenders of Marriage. And this is Deborah Bell on Queer Voices, and I now have on the line Jason Stewart. Hi, Jason.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me on the show.
I'm glad to have you. I was able to watch Coffee Date this weekend, and I enjoyed it very much.
Oh, I play Clayton.
Yes, you do. And tell me who Clayton is in this movie.
Clayton is sort of that guy in the office who's a drone, who is sort of lonely and very much wants to be involved in everybody's life. He's sort of gossipy and never really listens to everything that you say because he's so busy trying to be liked and misunderstands almost everything, but really is a sweet guy when he comes to it.
Yes, that's the impression that I got, was he was a really very caring person, but it's part of this his personality that kind of carries the plot line along, because the premise of the movie, which I just loved it when I read this, it says, when an internet coffee date goes awry, comedy ensues. And I thought, isn't that every coffee date we have from online meeting?
Oh,
don't,
God,
don't they
yes.
always end up that way? But you are the co-worker of one of the main characters, Todd, and he's set up on a blind date by his brother, Barry, as a joke. Barry sets him up with another guy whose name happens to be Kelly. And so until they actually meet, Todd doesn't know that Kelly is a he.
Yes.
But then what happens?
Oh, I'm not going to tell you. You have to go see the movie when it opens on the 17th.
Well, actually, I did see the movie. So
not you.
Yeah.
All the people who are listening.
It
opens on the 17th at the Angelica Film Center.
Right.
Right there in Houston, Texas. And I'm a big, big fan of Houston. I did my first, one of my first openly gay stand-up comedy shows.
That's
at the last stop.
Right.
In 1993. And I remember getting a standing ovation before I got onto stage.
Yep.
And that was the first time that ever happened to me. And so Houston has a very soft spot in my heart. And also, one of my boyfriends came from Houston, and he broke my heart. He's out there, Greg. And I haven't talked to him in probably 10 years.
Paybacks are hell, aren't they?
Well, for him or for me?
Well, now you're blasting it on the radio.
Oh, I guess so, huh? I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, like, so now everyone knows.
I just think I'm talking to you.
Well, the surprise to Todd, of course, is that his date ends up being with Kelly, who's a very proud, openly gay man. But they actually, because they do have a lot in common, which they've already found out online.
And it's played by Wilson Cruz.
Yes.
Who's on Noah's Ark now, and also toured with Rent and Tick, Tick, Boom, and used to be on My So-Called Life when he was younger.
Yeah, and he's very good, very cute.
And he's not just cute, he's gorgeous.
Yeah, and although I still don't think Kelly is a Puerto Rican name. But
well, just because you're Puerto Rican doesn't mean you have to have a Puerto Rican name. This is 2006. This is not the 30s, Debbie. If this were the 30s, maybe then that would have happened. But this is 2006. We've moved on just a touch.
Well, I don't know if that's moving on exactly, but he is delightful and very good looking. And
hot.
And Todd is also very good looking. Todd is played by Jonathan Bray.
And his brother is played by Jonathan Silverman,
uh-huh.
who most people will know from the series Weekend at Bernie's.
Exactly.
The series of movies and the TV series show, The Single Guy. And he'll be on, the show called In Case of Emergency in January.
Wow. That's one of the things about this movie. It seems to have quite a few very recognizable names and some pretty, I would say, high-end people, such as Sally Kirkland being the producer. And
oh, you know Sally Kirkland?
Yes, of course.
Oh, nominated for an Academy Award for Anna, and also for starring in the movie EdTV along with Matthew McConaughey.
Yes, and she plays Todd's mother, and
she's hysterical.
Absolutely, because I think that was one of the things about this movie. Not only does Clayton not listen, but almost everyone else doesn't listen because what happens is Kelly and Todd form a friendship based on their common interest, and they kind of play a joke back on Todd's brother, which ends up just spiraling out of control, which is that everyone thinks that Todd really is gay.
Mm-hmm.
And there even comes a point where Todd questions if he really is gay.
Yes, and then we don't want to tell them what happened.
No, mustn't do that.
And it's very hot, and it's very sexy, and it's very funny.
Yes, and there's a lot of little twists in the plot. Everything from the company where Clayton and Todd work and how they deal with it, and, of course, how Todd's brother reacts and how his mother reacts, And also what happens with the friendship between Kelly and Todd.
It's very sweet.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of truths about this movie is that people are people. They want intimacy, they want friendship, and they want love. And there are levels to that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people would say, well, can a straight guy really be friends with a gay man?
Oh, come on.
And,
of course. I love straight people. I have two to clean my house. They're great people.
And another named person in this movie, she has a fairly small role, but a big part in another way, and that's Deborah Gibson, who used to be called Debbie Gibson, and she did the music.
She did the song, just one of the songs, the theme song for the film. It's called Sounds Like Love.
Yes, it's a lovely song.
Isn't it pretty?
It is. And another cameo appearance, I guess you would call it, is by Lee Taylor Young.
Oh, do you know her from Passions?
Well, I've seen her from a long time ago. I mean, I've been around a while, so I'm familiar with the name. And she is looking fabulous. She always was a very beautiful woman, but really is. And
Elaine Hendricks is in it. She plays sort of the best friend of Kelly.
She calls herself Kelly's fag hag.
Right.
But hardly a hag, is she?
Oh, she's beautiful.
Yeah.
And she's also, people will know her from playing the mean stepmother in The Parent Trap. And she was also, she always plays the bitch. She was in Michelle's Wedding and Superstar. And for the gay film, people get your stuff. They know that. And we did a film called Dog together with Dennis Leary a couple years ago. And
mm-hmm.
She's just terrific. And mm-hmm. it also stars some just wonderful, wonderful, funny people. Carolyn Susie used to be on Something So Wonderful. There's just the TV show, and it's just got so many wonderful, Lisa Ann Walter, who was in Shall We Dance, and just some very funny, wonderful women.
Uh-huh. How did you become involved with this project?
My agent at the time submitted me for a role, and they called me. We went out to lunch, and that was it. A week later, they called me and said they offered me the role. And then I got involved, you know, and I became very friendly. Stuart, the director, Stuart Wade, and his husband, Antonio Brown, who's the executive producer, are now on their way. Well, right now, as we speak, they're watching Barbara Streisand.
So I heard, because he was initially going to do the interview, and then it's like, oh, I'm sorry, got to go see Babs.
Oh, yeah.
Which any one of us would have done.
Please, when it comes to Barbara.
Yeah, I know. How did such a small independent movie end up with such a great cast?
Well, I think once one got on, Sally got on first. First Elaine, then Sally, then me, and then all of a sudden we started calling our friends.
Mm-hmm. It pays to have friends.
Definitely.
And the movie has been doing very well at both mainstream and gay and lesbian film festivals. Would you consider this a gay film?
Yeah, I think it is a gay film, but straight people really dig it.
Uh-huh.
It's not a film that straight people wouldn't like. It's very romantic, and it's fun, and it's silly, and it also has a lot to say.
Yeah, when I was thinking about that when I viewed it, and I thought, I hope straight people go see this, because as I said, there are truths that are revealed about people, just relationships and family, and how maybe we don't necessarily really listen to one another, and how we can be more accepting of people, and kind of sets an example. Todd reminded me a little bit of Will Ferrell.
Oh, yeah, I would think so, definitely.
Yeah, and he seems
Better looking.
Yes, in my opinion, yes. But he kind of gets lost in his... He becomes what we call questioning as part of, you know, dealing with... Because he does end up having feelings for Kelly, but he just doesn't know how to face them or how to address them.
Well, he's having a bad time after his divorce.
Yes. Oh, in fact, there's this really cute little part where his ex-wife confronts him because his mother called and says that she made him gay.
Right.
And but I think what the end result is how we self-identify and how we find self-acceptance. And that's a good message for everyone.
I think that's so, too. And who you are is fine.
Well, This is Deborah Bell, and I've been talking to the marvelous Jason Stewart about the movie Coffee Date.
Yes, and if anybody wants to know where to go see the movie, of course, it's at the Angelica Theater. This Friday it opens. And if anybody wants to see what I look like, because I'm single, it's jasonstewart.com, S-T-U-A-R-T. And if anybody wants to know anything about the movie, go to coffeedate.com, the movie, coffeedatethemovie.com.
Boy, you are prepared. Well, thank you so much for being with us tonight on Queer Voices, Jason.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Okay. Thank you. Good night. And I want to make sure that I let our listeners know that Lou Mitchell will be performing Saturday, December the 9th at 8 p.m. at the Mill Bend Coffee House. She performs an eclectic mix of musical featuring her original songs, which are usually outrageously funny and frequently encouraging audience participation. She's a prize-winning singer-songwriter, and she pokes good-natured fun at TV evangelists, doctors, lawyers, or anything else that tickles her sense of the absurd in the land of Big Macs, Wonder Bras, and I almost said Wonder Balls. Big Macs, Wonder Bras, and the Internet. And she has songs with titles like The Mammogram, Martha Stewart, Have You No Shame, and The Viagra Sing Along. She's going to be at the Mill Bend Coffee House up in the Woodlands area on Saturday, December the 9th. And the number to call is 281-350-3052, and that's also at www.millbend.org for more information. And now we have the lovely Jennifer Renee.
The way you look at me and pause.
And the also lovely Lily Roddy.
Well, good evening.
Yes. This is Jennifer Renee. This evening we have Lily Roddy, who is co-chair of the Houston Transgendered Unity Committee. And we're going to talk about the Transgender Day of Remembrance, which is next Monday at 6:30 over at the Holocaust Museum. And what was that address?
That's 5401 Caroline Street.
And for many people, we talked about this last year. This is the eighth annual here, isn't it? Now, nationwide.
No, eighth annual nationally.
Nationally. Okay. And where did it start?
It started in California, and it was started with remembering one particular transgender person, and that was in San Francisco in 1999, and the woman was Rita Hester. And she was murdered, and they sort of created this event, sort of generated from that.
Okay, let's take a step back and so that the audience can understand, what is the Day of Remembrance all about?
Well, the Day of Remembrance is essentially to remember the transgender people that are murdered every year simply because they're transgendered and for no other reason. And oftentimes transgendered people that are murdered are usually the murder itself is usually a horrendous event, and they're not just shot, you know, like robbing their purse or their wallet. Actually, they're shot several times, and this year there are people who are stoned and stoned to death. I just can't believe that people do that. And you know, but it's just always horrific. Horrific murders.
This is all about hate, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's purely a hate crime.
Now, if I understand correctly, it's the Day of Remembrance isn't about just anyone in the community that died. The people that we're talking about are those that were transgendered who were murdered. Now, I understood that also includes those perceived transgender. Is that correct?
Exactly. And the Day of Remembrance, the DOR, is actually a day that's celebrated honoring people who are murdered, and it's all over the world. I mean, there are honoring celebrations all over, and I think this year there's approximately 200 different DOR, Day of Remembrance events throughout the world. So it's not just a United States thing, or you know, it's a bigger event, and we honor everyone who's been murdered from all over the world.
Before we move on, if they need some more information about the event, how could they find out?
They can probably go to transhouston.com, and on there, transhouston, which just like it sounds, transhouston.com, and on there is a link to the Transgender Day of Remembrance, which is just TGDOR.org. And there are the events there and some listings and about the history, and particularly some of the history here since it was started by a particular trans person here, Vanessa.
Vanessa Edwards Foster.
Absolutely.
So we'll give her full
Foster.
Credit. One of the questions I had was, now, as far as the Day of Remembrance, it's memorial is at the Holocaust Museum on next Monday night at 6:30 to about 8:30.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. But there's more activities around this. Aren't there some other events that are planned around this day?
Yes, the Sunday evening prior to this at the Transgender Drop-In Center, we're going to have a...
And where is that?
That's at, 25, and I can't remember the date. It's on Morgan Street in Pacifica. And there we're going to have a... it's 2520 Morgan. And we're going to have a self-defense class there from 7 until 9 p.m. And open to anyone, actually doesn't have to be transgendered. And we're just going to sort of deal with learning how to be safe and how to be aware and how to protect yourself. And for always, the most important thing in self-defense is running away. So
in high heels, learning to run in high heels.
Would other people be welcome to attend that are not transgender?
Absolutely. We encourage, in fact, that's one of the reasons we try to really encourage and reach out to all of the different, just the larger community, not only the GLBT community, which is, we welcome their participation as they have always participated every year, but also to bring in all of the people in the larger community, the straight community, because, without a bigger picture and everyone being educated about this cycle of violence won't stop.
And are not some of the hate crimes that are perpetrated on transgendered people because of the perception that they're gay or lesbian?
That's also a part of it, and sometimes it's also a hate crime specifically associated with being sometimes just being female.
Yes.
As I was talking to the HPD, and they sort of described some of the things that how they sort of describe it as a hate crime related to women.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Because we know how homophobia and sexism are so closely related.
Exactly.
The fact that you're holding this at the Holocaust Museum, and I think this is the second year that it's been held there, is
exactly.
That correct?
Exactly. Uh-huh.
Is there a significance of that?
Yes. It's an interesting connection. The Holocaust Museum is actually named after a gentleman who was doing transgender research. He was also doing research on homosexuals at that particular time, and
when was this?
This was right before the war, and in fact, when the
what is the name? She has it there in her notes somewhere
in my notes.
Now, this was the war, meaning the Second World War.
The Second World War, exactly.
And with the little guy with the funny mustache.
Mm-hmm.
Who had nothing funny about him.
Nothing.
No.
Dr. Magnus Hirschfeld.
Yes.
In fact, he was first one to coin two of the popular terms to describe transgenderism, which was transvestitism, and then later transsexualism. And so he had a big institute there. And
where was this?
In Germany in the 1920s. And they actually did M2F surgery at that particular time. And the Nazis came in and raided and took all of his records and...
Mm-hmm.
And, and of course, that's where we got the pink, triangle symbol from.
There was a thriving, progressive, gay, lesbian, transgender community at that time. Mm-hmm. And if you go back and read the book, I Am a Camera, which most of us recognize as the movie, the musical Cabaret.
Exactly.
Which was written by a gay man. And it touches upon some of that time, and so among the others that were selected by the Nazis
for persecution.
For persecution, not only was it Jews, but it was gypsies. the homosexuals, lesbians tended to fall into a group that they called asocial. And the black triangle was associated with that. And for transgendered and homosexuals, it was the pink triangle. And I experienced in 1993 the opening of the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. And I'll never forget seeing those SS uniforms and seeing one of the pink triangles that actually had been placed on a person. And in some of the stories that they told were about homosexual individuals that had been sent to the death camps. And it made me remember why. Because at that point, it was just before the March on Washington in 93 that I was working on. And I told the story many times, but it was I was just at the point where I was exhausted. We were just working, you know, 14, 16-hour days, 7 days a week to make the thing happen. And I'm thinking, and getting complaints from this way and that. And why are we doing this? Why are we doing this? And there was my answer. This is why we're doing this. This is why we almost will always have to do this, because it could happen again, as evidenced by the interview that Glenn and Greg had with the Reverend Mel White, talking about who might be selected next for persecution.
Well, probably like it was in Nazi Germany after they raided the Institute. It was the transgenders they rounded up as deviants. And they were sent to the camps along with the gypsies and other groups that we're all familiar with, to the death camps.
Anyone who wasn't considered of the pure Aryan race.
Exactly.
And also people that were disabled or mentally challenged.
It was what do you say? The fear is eternal vigilance on the part of our community. And as we remember those murdered on the Transgender Day of Remembrance, and the reason for it is because of our eternal vigilance. This is happening today.
Isn't that the price of freedom? Isn't that the saying? The price of freedom is eternal vigilance.
And into this day, in this country, it is just as possible for that to happen again if a few good people stand by and let it happen.
And as it often happens, I mean, we just, now there's a, you know, just about to be a court case where some local people are discriminating against some gay men who run a nursery, you know, and that's been put out on the internet, and those people are not utilizing their services because they're gay.
No, what the story is, there's some people that refuse to do business with a gay couple.
Right,
The business is a heterosexual couple.
Yeah, they're heterosexual, but they're refusing to let gay people.
They choose not to do business with homosexuals.
And the reason is that there's no public accommodation ordinance or laws in the state of Texas to protect anyone from that kind of discrimination. Now, you would have heard a loud roar if it had been a black or Hispanic that were denied service.
Or Jewish. any of the protected classes.
But it is legal to discriminate against gays, lesbians, bisexuals, and transgenders in the state of Texas.
But just because it's legal don't make it right.
I'm not saying it's right. I'm saying it's very wrong.
Indeed, of course. And
it's even more wrong that our city and our state does not protect its citizens equally.
That's true. And before we go to a segment of This Way Out, is there anything else that you want to tell us, Lily, that we didn't get to ask about?
Well, I wanted to remark that part of what we're doing this year is we're sort of expanding the program in terms of what we're doing on the Day of Remembrance, and we're looking at violence in a much more expanded format rather than just strictly people who are murdered, but how we're discriminated against in families and at work and just culturally. So we're trying to take a bigger picture and include that as part of the picture of violence.
Now, who's going to be there to speak?
Well, for sure we have Anise Parker is going to come to speak, and we have some gentlemen from the Houston Police Department. I'll be sort of the master of ceremonies, and Kristen Williams will be there, Joanna Fields, Chris Truex, Erica Kizzy will be there speaking. I can't remember everyone's names. So we should just have a nice presentation and a nice remembering of the people that have given their lives.
And remember, this is the Day of Remembrance is open to everyone, not just transgendered individuals, especially the GLBT people in our community, as well as the friends and allies of the community. So you're all welcome. Now remember, it is November 20th. That's next Monday at 6:30 at the Holocaust Museum. And the address of the Holocaust Museum is
5204. Oh, I think that's right. I'll have to remember the address again. And but I also want to say, as we open our doors at 6:30, and from that there'll be food and drinks there for everyone to come enjoy.
All right. Thank you, Lily Roddy.
Well, thank you very much for asking me to come and help promote this. And we just appreciate it so much.
And the website again for more information
is transhouston.com. And on there is the other website as well.
Okay. This is Queer Voices.
This is Queer Voices.
Kosovo to Queer TV, he's covered the world's hotspots. We'll meet Logo anchorman Jason Bellini later in the program. Voters in more than two dozen U.S. states since 2002 have passed amendments to their constitutions, making marriage a strictly heterosexual institution. And it's an issue that's consistently rallied the religious fundamentalist wing of the Republican Party to the polls. Among the eight states where such measures were on the ballot this week, LGBT activists nationwide look to Wisconsin and Arizona as having the best chances of turning back the tide. We have comments by leaders of Arizona's first-in-the-nation defeat of a broadly discriminatory ballot measure, but we'll turn first to This Way Out correspondent John Quinlan in Madison for a report about the loss in Wisconsin. Despite a bankroll of over $5 million and more than 10,000 volunteers campaigning across the state against the measure, Wisconsin voters approved a constitutional ban on same-gender marriage and civil unions by what to some was a stunning margin, 59-41%.
The obvious question remains, what happened here in a state with a long history of fairness and the advancement of civil rights? In fact, next year marks the 25th anniversary of Wisconsin's first-in-the-nation law prohibiting discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, and this election marked an almost 2-1 re-election victory of the nation's first-ever openly lesbian congresswoman, Tammy Baldwin, for a fifth term. In an interview with WORT-FM reporter Laura Goodconnect, Representative Baldwin's feelings reflected those of many of her constituents.
Congratulations. Congratulations. It's kind of a bittersweet night, though, isn't it?
It really is. You know, on one hand, I'm elated with my own election results and the news that I just heard that the House of Representatives will be under Democratic control next session. I'm heartbroken about the results of the amendment here in the state of Wisconsin. Just told the audience here at Monona Terrace that I think that the effort waged to defeat the amendment was one of the most dignified and loving and incredible campaigns I've ever seen waged in Wisconsin.
In a surprisingly rousing concession speech before a gathering of almost 500 supporters in Madison, Mike Tate, Director of Fair Wisconsin, the organization which led efforts to turn back the amendment, was defiantly optimistic in his belief that this decision would be eventually overturned.
My friends, tonight we came up short in our struggle for equality. While we lost today, we will not lose the long term. We will achieve fairness and equality in our state and in our country, in our time.
Among the silver linings he noted in the election included the victory of outspoken gay community supporter, the incumbent governor, Jim Doyle, and the defeat of State Representative John Gard in his bid for Congress. Gard had originally introduced the measure.
Today we learned that when elected leaders courageously and unequivocally speak out against these measures, they win. And that when other so-called leaders jump on the bandwagon of anti-gay extremism, we know that they end up in the unemployment line. And that is a very good thing for this state, and we should be very proud of that.
In And so the question remains, why was it Arizona, not Wisconsin, to be the first state to defeat one of these hatred-driven amendments? Ironically, polling results showed that the Foley and Hagerty scandals, while also hurting Republican incumbents, quite possibly raised their worst fears about gay people in outlying areas of the state, reversing previous gains. Part of the answer, however, may also lie in looking at Dane County, where Madison is the county seat. Here our neighbors know us well, and they joined us by voting to turn back the amendment by a margin of almost 2-1. As a campaign and fundraising effort, the Fair Wisconsin campaign against the amendment was marked by some great successes in the depth of the bipartisan support it generated, its ability to mobilize progressive faith communities, its effectiveness in mobilizing non-traditional voters statewide. And yet I'd argue the TV commercials and canvassing efforts alone will never be the answer. Despite our best efforts, in the end, in the latest polls, less than half of all Wisconsinites today admit to even knowing a gay person. And so we return to the most powerful lesson that our movement has taught us. People won't vote against us if they see us as their family, friends, and neighbors. That work may take many years, but those efforts can and will continue to produce important changes for everyone. For This Way Out, in WRTFM community-sponsored radio, this is John Quinlan.
In Arizona, generally viewed as a politically conservative state, opponents of legal recognition for queer couples almost certainly lost, although the margin was only about 3 percentage points, because their ballot measure went much further than banning same-gender marriage or civil unions. It would have also stripped all couples registered as domestic partners in the state, whether same-gender or heterosexual, of their rights, such as health benefits and hospital visitation. In order to maintain government benefits that they would lose through marriage, a notable number of heterosexual senior citizen couples have joined queer couples in registering as domestic partners in Arizona's largest county and cities. Senior couples were prominently featured in the campaign spearheaded by Arizona Together, the LGBT-led group formed to fight the ballot measure. They raised $2.1 million and mobilized more than 18,000 volunteers to campaign against the measure. Their leaders credited long-term strategizing, the use of polling and focus groups to formulate a successful campaign message that voters would understand and relate to, and staying on message as the keys to victory. Joe Juhas is with Reister, a political consulting firm that worked with Arizona Together on the campaign.
Every ballot campaign and candidate campaign, very honestly, has certain responsibilities. And I think one of those key responsibilities is to inform the voters not simply of the intent of a ballot measure, but its consequences. And I think we fulfill that responsibility. I can't say the other side did that. They talked about the intent, but they never did talk about the consequences. And in fact, when they were faced with questions regarding the consequences, they simply refused to answer them.
Veteran openly gay Arizona Republican state legislator Steve May, the treasurer of Arizona Together.
We didn't hide the fact that this was a gay marriage ban. We didn't hide the fact that this would affect gay people. But we communicated not just to our donor base, we communicated to a majority of voters about issues they cared about. And that is the key to victory.
This was a very intentional attack on all unmarried couples.
Kirsten Sinema chaired Arizona Together.
The proponents disguised it as attack simply on the gay community because of the political capital that they thought they could buy from that. The good news is that Arizona voters really responded to our message of unity, and I think our name reflected that, Arizona Together. And Arizona voters understood that we were all in this together and that all unmarried people would be affected.
You know, not every municipal government in Arizona offers domestic partnership benefits. There is now, I believe, going to be a desire on the part of many communities to do that.
Again, Reister political consultant Joe Juhas.
Municipal officials who perhaps were reluctant to venture in that area before that now feel, whether we like it or not, you know, they're politicians. And they're going to want to have a sense of security before they go down a certain path. Well, we have provided that sense of security now. The business community that offers those types of partnership benefits, I believe, again, are going to feel more comfortable doing so. I think that the Arizona GLBT community has clearly established itself now as a political force that could become, and in fact is influential, in all matters of public policy. And that's something that, you know, frankly, I really didn't focus on until the last few days, as I just hear the buzz around the state, what a tremendous achievement this was.
we'll let Arizona Together Treasurer Steve May have the final word.
I just want this to be the beginning of a new trend. A new trend for the GLBT community for sure, but a new trend in American politics. And I think we've hopefully developed a model that will work in other places and provided some hope and inspiration for people across the country that we don't have to put up with the extremists winning the elections all the time. We can win, and we should, and we will.
That was Steve May of Arizona Together, and with John Quinlan in Madison, Wisconsin, I'm Greg Gordon reporting for This Way Out.
Hi, this is Georgina Beyer. I'm an MP in the New Zealand Parliament, the world's first transsexual to have been elected to such a position. You're listening to This Way Out. Stay out and proud.
Hello, I'm Dr. Robert Simmons, Jr. of Lebanon, Ohio, a longtime This Way Out listener and donor. In memory of my mother, Mabel Simmons, I'm issuing a matching challenge to supporters of this volunteer-driven nonprofit operation. Please visit thiswayout.org to see how your help to keep this program on the air will now be worth twice as much. You'll also get a tax deduction if you're in the United States, and you'll find some unique holiday gifts there too. Again, please log on to thiswayout.org. We'll all be very thankful.
Logo is a U.S.-based digital cable television channel featuring programming aimed at the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender communities. Viacom's MTV Networks division launched the venture on June 30, 2005. The venerable CBS TV network provides news for the channel, and a young gay man named Jason Bellini delivers it. This Way Out's Steve Pride reports on the reporter, who's much more than just another talking head.
This is CBS News on Logo. I'm Jason Bellini. Marriage versus civil unions. That's the new hot debate in New Jersey.
I'm Jason Bellini from CBS News on Logo. CBS News does the news for Logo. We are the vendor of news to Logo, and CBS News puts its brand name on the news.
As the sole news anchor on Logo, the gay cable channel, Jason Bellini is the new face of gay journalism in America. It is a really nice face. But more importantly, the seasoned former CNN correspondent brings an impeccable news background to the job.
This is Queer Voices.
Well, we didn't quite have time for that last segment of This Way Out.
We had so many good guests tonight. It was a full show.
And some talkers here in the studio.
That too.
And we need to thank our guest tonight, the Reverend Mel White, talking with Glenn Holt and Greg Chapman about his latest book, Religion Gone Bad.
And, of course, Jeff Reed from Houston Equal Rights Alliance talking about the election results.
I talked with Jason Stewart, one of the co-stars of Coffee Date, which will be opening Friday at the Angelica.
And Lily Roddy, who joined us to discuss the Transgender Day of Remembrance next Monday, the 20th, at the Holocaust Museum.
Also, we had Frida Mock talking about the film Wrestling with Angels, which is about Tony Kushner.
And so join us next week on the show when we talk about the holiday blues with folks from the Montrose Counseling Center. Tracy Gary, who has a long history with philanthropy, will join us to talk about her latest effort.
And Keith Eschenberg will discuss with me the growing use of organics in cosmetics and hair products, stopping the current use of dangerous chemicals.
And we'll have our usual features of This Way Out, commentary, and music.
And a couple of things happening this week is Ray Hill's documentary, The Prison Show, along with The Last Days of Charles Catherine McGuire. And that's playing at the Rice Media Center November 17th through the 19th at 8 p.m., also, the Victory Fund is having their national conference here in Houston at the JW Marriott Hotel out on Westheimer at the Galleria. And if you want some more information on that, go to victoryfund.org. queerbelief.org. That should be really good. Barney Frank's going to be in town, along with Mr. Dean, who's the head of the Democratic Party, along with some other stuff. And thank everybody who pledged to KPFT and Queer Voices. And if you haven't fulfilled your pledge yet, please do so.
And if you didn't pledge, you can still make a donation.
You still can. And for Queer Voices.
And stay tuned for World Village Cafe and join us next week on Queer Voices.
Listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, Jennifer Renee, Greg Chapman, and Jack Valensky. Be sure to listen every Saturday night, Sunday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org.
Here at KPFT, your vote matters most. Now here's a word from one of our candidates.
I'm Bill Crozier. I'm a candidate for the KPFT Local Station Board. Here's why. KPFT offers a beacon of hope that we so desperately need. Our government has violated the founding principles of this country and turned its back on ethics and morality. KPFT is the only Houston station speaking the truth about how our leaders have betrayed us and about how we must stand up for what's right.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.